Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I am joined this morning by my colleagues, Judges Johnson and Larson, and we are ready for the third case on our calendar of three. That case is State of Minnesota versus Carlos Rosas, A221154. And counsel, I know that you're both make frequent appearances before this court. I'll be brief in my admonitions to you this morning. As you know, appellant has 15 minutes for argument, respondent has 15 minutes for argument, and appellant has a 5-minute rebuttal. We'll be counting down your time with a clock that you should be able to see on your screen. Can you both see that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, okay. Your Honor.
Great. We are making an audio recording of the arguments this morning, and to ensure that our recording is clear, I just ask that you introduce yourself and the party you represent before you begin presenting your argument. And then when you're not making an argument, please make sure that your mute button is on so that we don't have any audio interference. And with that, I think we are ready to get started. We will first hear from counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Maravilli. I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Carlos Rosas. This appeal presents primarily an issue of statutory interpretation, which on appeal receives de novo review, on the question of whether a conviction must be reversed because the conduct on which the conviction was based, whether the charge itself or an element of the charge, in this case, the burglary charges, is not governed by the statute under which it was charged. In this case, I have argued that based on the record made at trial and the evidence received, that the threat attributed to my client did not constitute an assault, whether regular assault or domestic. It was instead and must be classified as a threat of violence. There is no evidence in the record to indicate that there was an intent for this threat to be immediately acted upon. This is a requirement of the assault statutes of all degrees. I have relied on State v. Colvin to sum up the standard of review here for the premise that even a conviction rendered by a jury cannot stand if, on appellate review, it is determined that the conduct put in the record is not governed by the statute. Now, State v. Murphy established unequivocally the difference between a threat that constitutes an assault and a threat that would be governed by the threats of violence statute, formerly terroristic threats. Any threat that does not convey an intent to act upon it immediately, that does not convey the conclusion, direct, circumstantial, that the actor intended to act upon it immediately, is not governed by the assault statute. Instead, the threats of violence, which governs under Murphy, a threat to commit future harm or a threat to commit harm at some indefinite, unknown point. To illustrate this point, in my brief, I relied primarily on the State v. Smith case from 2012, which is rather startling in both the conduct that was proven and then how the court analyzed it. In that case, the defendant entered the apartment, very similar to this case, and immediately brandished a knife, which in itself is a threatening act, but it was because of his words, "Give me the money or I will hurt you," that the Smith court had to find that this demonstrated his intent was to immediately carry out the threat demonstrated frustrated by the knife and his other threatening conduct. I mean, he was belligerent. He was physically threatening. But his words alone canceled out the applicability of the assault statute.
Mr. Marvelli, if I could pause you, your argument for just a moment. Generally, in the cases that you are presenting to us in part one of your brief, are they arising, appellate opinions arising from prosecutions for assault like this case, or are they opinions arising from prosecutions for terroristic threats or threats of violence? In other words, I'm looking for a case that's like this case and that in which there was a prosecution for assault based upon fear, but the appellate court said that the evidence was insufficient because it was because of the nature of the threat. And I'm just wondering if you have cases of that type, or if you're simply trying to juxtapose this case with cases of the other type. If you understand my question, I'm wondering if you could answer generally about the case law you cite, and specifically then about Murphy and Smith.
I do follow your question. I will say at first that the cases that I was prepared here to speak about, both Smith from 2012, I also cited the Johnson case from this court in 2009. That's the non-precedential one. In that case, there was a conviction for threats of violence, but on appeal, the appellant tried to argue that his conduct was an assault. I've gone through the Smith case already. In the Johnson case, the defendant made a threat to kill. Again, very similar here, but this court said that because, well, one, the threat wasn't carried out, but also no effort was made to carry it out, that it could not be an assault. So I don't know that I respectfully agree with the characterization that this is mere juxtaposed analysis. I think that it is vital statutory analysis, especially to consider that both Smith and Johnson very clearly, and well, Murphy for that matter, clearly explained what threats of violence is and how an actual assault is not a threat of violence.
Can I pause you again and say, am I correct in understanding that your premise, I think one of the premises of your arguments is that any particular fact pattern must fit into one category, or at least, you know, be governed by one offense or the other, but never both. In other words, there's no set of facts that could be a criminal offense under, potentially a criminal offense under both statutes. Is that your premise?
It is. And Your Honor, just to be clear, I mean, I can't go through them all, but I looked at a large number of cases related to this issue. And Murphy essentially establishes the benchmark here. It is either or. I am not aware of any authority, nor did I see any cited in respondent's brief, that this conduct can be overlapping. I also believe that the rules of construction and interpretation would not permit such a practice. The threats of violence statute and the assault statutes define discrete acts of a threatening nature. So that is why the decisions that were reached in Murphy, Smith, and Johnson came down to that. I think if I could perhaps further address your question, Your Honor, I did note that one of the cases cited by respondent was the Ali case, ALI, from 2014. In that case, it was initially charged as a threats of violence case, but it was pled down to the misdemeanor assault, and that is how it wound up being an assault. But that is only because the defendant admitted in the plea, in his colloquy, that his intent was to immediately act on it. So even in that sense, unless there's evidence in the record to allow for the conclusion that the intent was there, it can't be an assault. I'd like to address the supplemental.
I mean, it seems to me, our real task here is looking at the trial evidence and determining whether it's sufficient to sustain the predicate, the jury's determination that the predicate offense of assault fear was satisfied. And looking at that evidence, we have someone who's entering a house without permission. And then when the police are called, makes a statement that amounts to a threat to kill the complainant. Isn't that all that's really required for a jury to determine that he had the requisite intent to commit the predicate offense of assault fear?
The jury is the one that has to decide whether the intent was there, yes. But the position I'm taking in this appeal, and again, I rely on State v. Colvin for this, which actually was a burglary case, is that on appellate review, the jury's verdict cannot stand. Again, if the de novo appellate review makes clear conduct described in the record isn't governed by the statute, the jury isn't the expert on that, and they're not the ones who rule on or decide the law. They breached their decision, an erroneous one, based on the law they were given. This is an error by the court. This is an error by the state in the way the case was charged. And appeals exist to remedy such errors.
So I guess one problem that I have with the argument that you're making is I think it's premised on this idea that the threat that was made was somehow conditional. And I don't really track that argument that it was an argument that was, or that it was a threat that was making some sort of conditional threat to kill based on whether he ended up in jail. And that reading of that statement doesn't make any sense to me. So perhaps you can help me with that.
I think Smith is the case I would rely on the most, because there it was the same thing. I mean, the word if is not the only, indicator here as to whether the intent was immediate. In Smith, again, while holding a knife, which, I would concede in that case, if he just held up the knife and didn't say anything, that's an assault. Words are what matter here. I am relying on Smith for the idea that this statement by my client, that again, it was the prosecutor that put in. Ms. Rosas never testified, or I'm sorry, Ms. Aller, I can't remember her last name. The accuser never actually testified to this statement, but it was, if I'm going to jail, it would be because I'm going to kill you. This wasn't followed. And this is where I want to weave in that supplemental authority respondent cited Holmgren. That case just proves my point even more, because the conduct of the defendant in that case was physically threatening.
So is your interpretation of that statement that if he goes to jail, he's going to get out? And
no,
he's gonna come back?
I think what I interpret is that he would do that before he went to jail. I mean, that's one interpretation of it. Since we never got the accuser's interpretation of it, much less what he actually said, we're just left with that meaning. But it was, I mean, those, Your Honor, those statements alone indicate, just like in Johnson and Smith, it was not his intent to act on it immediately. That is the dividing line here. And forgive me, but it seems crystal clear. The other cases I cited in my brief, I know, also illustrate the fact that unless there is physically aggressive behavior, brandishing a weapon, or other statements like, I'm going to kill you, just like that, it's not an assault, Your Honor.
So you say he was not intending to act immediately. When was he intending to act on it, under your interpretation?
I don't believe he ever intended to act on it, Your Honor. And I think—
But if we assume that he did intend to put her in fear, In fear of what, at what time? Well, in fear of, maybe not the what, in fear of death or bodily harm, or death in specific, but when did he, what did, excuse me, what, when is the time when she should fear being killed by him?
Sometime in the future.
But how long? I mean, can you be more specific than that?
Well, I can't. The record provide me with any more evidence of his intent other than that what he did was turn around and leave the house. Under Johnson, that means it wasn't an assault. I think that the evidence can also allow for the ready conclusion that it was an empty threat.
But at the time he spoke it, I mean, he was still, I think they had just confronted each other and he was still standing there. And isn't that the appropriate time for us to measure the conduct?
Yes, as long as the reasoning from cases like Smith and Johnson are applied, and I would say Holmgren, that respondent has provided. All of those cases had accompanying actions and words, physical aggression. In Holmgren, the defendant blocked the defendant's path on the steps and bumped into him, using physical aggression to convey an intent to harm immediately. My client is alleged to have just stood there, said what he said, the accuser just called the police and he left. I can only rely on the analysis that has been made so often by this court and the Supreme Court, that if there is no evidence to indicate that he intended to act on it immediately, it is not an assault, Your Honor. So there's how long you're asking. The evidence requires that he show an immediate intent. That is the statutory requirement. If there is any delay, either in the time frame he offers or in his own actions, it is not an assault because that's not his intent to act immediately. I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Maravilla. You'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. And next we will hear from counsel for respondent. Mr. Bueller, you may begin when you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. I appreciate the fact that you're allowing me to appear by Zoom this morning. You're saving me an almost 600-mile round trip. My name is Scott Bueller. I'm the first assistant Polk County attorney. I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this criminal appeal. I just would note this is a somewhat unusual case. Let the court know I didn't charge or try this case, and had I done so, I would have done it differently. Essentially, you have a case in which a threat to kill a victim was charged solely as misdemeanor domestic assault. As counsel's acknowledged, it clearly could have been charged with threats of violence. In fact, counsel goes so far as to say his client should have been charged with a felony rather than a misdemeanor. Now, of course, that's an argument that was never raised before the district court in any way, shape, or form. And I would note that in my almost 30 years as a prosecutor, I can't recall a case in which I've ever had a defendant who said I should be charged with a felony rather than a misdemeanor. I also would note with regard to the burglary in the first degree, the occupied dwelling offense, you know, again, the prosecutor made his life a little more difficult than he needed to in this case, because he could have simply alleged the Danko was a violation and proved that up, or he could have alleged the threats of violence. There are multiple other ways of doing this, but we're stuck with the record as it is. And in this case, the prosecutor chose to charge this threat to kill the victim as a domestic assault. Now, as counsel acknowledges, this is an issue of statutory interpretation, which this court reviews de novo. So it comes down to the statute. Can an act committed with intent to cause fear in another of immediate bodily harm or death, as defined in Minnesota Statute 609.2242 subdivision 1 parentheses 1, constitute an assault based upon solely upon a verbal threat to kill? Now, counsel's entire argument is based upon terroristic threats cases, and then arguing because those were deemed to be terroristic threats, they can't be a domestic assault or an assault. Counsel doesn't cite any case, and I would point to State versus Smith, which counsel has harped upon throughout his entire argument. Nowhere in that case does it say that the defendant, having been charged with assault in the fifth degree, was improperly charged in a case in which he also was charged with terroristic threats. This argument is similar to the one that the U.S. Supreme Court has said, relying on dubious logic in United States versus Knights. That is, that arguing that because cases address one type of issue, in that case, a particular type of search, then you argue that implicitly every other type of search that isn't identical must be unconstitutional. That's what counsel's arguing. My argument is a little more pragmatic. I think this case just simply presents the flip side to Murphy. Murphy was the case in which the Minnesota Supreme Court for the first time ruled that acts alone could constitute a terroristic threat. I mean, intuitively, when you hear the word terroristic threat, you would think that it has to be a verbal threat. And the Supreme Court said, no, it can be solely based upon acts. In this case, it's the flip side. It's can a verbal act or a verbal statement constitute an act under the assault statute? Now, I would note that the plain language of 609.2242 does not say physical act anywhere in there. And yet the Minnesota legislature has made it clear when it requires a physical act, that it is willing to 1B, in which it talks about a physical assault upon a peace officer. So the legislature knows how to draw the distinction between a physical act and one that isn't. And in this case, there's nothing in the statute that requires that this be a physical act. And counsel's argument that the defendant did not act upon his threat, I think, conflates the two subdivisions of the domestic assault statute. 1-1 is the assault fear. 1-2 is the infliction or attempt to flick. So if the defendant attempts to act upon that threat, he then has committed a separate violation of the law, which is distinct from this. The first subdivision simply focuses upon his act and the intent with which he made it. And I think counsel disregards much of what the argument that I made in this case, and that this court has noted, at least in the cases of involving domestic abuse, it said a verbal threat, depending on the words and circumstances, can also inflict fear of immediate physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. Followed up just more recently by Holmgren, in which this court said, we note that cases in which intent to cause fear is proved typically include evidence of the defendant's use of a verbal threat, weapon, or physical contact. And again, this court has found a sufficient factual basis for a guilty plea in State versus Ali based solely upon the words that were uttered to the victim that caused her to be scared and fear for her safety. And that's State versus Ali in 2014, and in State versus Bailey in 2007, this court treated assault in the fifth degree as a lesser included offense to a terroristic threats offense in that case, which would tends to undermine counsel's argument. If these were mutually exclusive, you would have had inconsistent verdicts rendered in that case. And I would note that the result in Ali is not all that unusual. It's over the course of my career, I've had multiple cases over the years where you have defendants who are charged with terroristic threats who offer to plead guilty to an assault based upon the words that they've uttered because it did cause fear in the victim, because they would rather be convicted of a misdemeanor rather than a felony. There's nothing unusual about that. And I've never had a court, and in fact, this court didn't say in Ali that these were mutually exclusive conduct, that because he'd been charged with terroristic threats, he could not be convicted of assault in the fifth degree or domestic assault. And that's what you have here. You have a defendant who has entered into somebody's home illegally without consent. There's no ifs, ands, or buts on this record that there was no consent for the defendant to enter. He did so in direct violation of a domestic abuse no contact order, which means there had been a prior finding of domestic abuse. He refused to leave when the victim told him to do so. It was at that point that she said that she was going to call the police, which she had every right to do. The defendant was in her home illegally in violation of a DANCO. She had every right to do so, to call police to seek assistance. And the defendant said that if he was going to jail, it was because he was going to kill her. Of course, she was talking about making a phone call right then and there. This is an immediate threat. He's attempting to stop her from doing something that the law provided her to do immediately, right then and there. As this court has noted in some of its other cases, immediacy does not require, as counsel would suggest, that you have to make the threat and then act upon it immediately, because if you do so, you've now crossed over to subdivision 1-2, you would make subdivision 1-1 irrelevant. And finally, counsel leaves out the fact that the victim in this case specifically said she was scared and feared for her life because she did not want to die. That was her statement in response to the defendant's threat to kill her. And then she at that point called 911. The defendant left the residence, was arrested shortly thereafter. He's taken to the jail, kicking, screaming, and yelling, and he makes several admissions and also several inconsistent statements. Granted, this may not have been the most overwhelming evidence of a domestic assault, but it simply does meet the statutory requirements. It was an act committed by the defendant. That is a verbal threat to kill her. And it was committed with intent to cause fear in her, of immediate bodily harm or death. Granted, he's talking about killing her if she calls 911, which is what she was going to do right then and there, not at some future point in time down the road. Why else would he make the
threat? Mr. Buehler, on that point, so I the statute uses the word immediate to cause fear in another of immediate bodily harm or death. What does the case law say about the scope of that concept, immediateness? I mean, what are the outer limits of that as demonstrated by the case law? I mean, how far in the future could it be the threatened event of actually causing harm or death?
Well, unfortunately, Your Honor, I don't have a good answer for you on that one. I can only say that this court addressed the term immediate in State versus Craig in 2021 and what it said near in time. And it's hard to go beyond the facts of this individual case, but we are talking here in which the defendant is illegally in her home. She's told him to leave, told him that she's going to call the police, and the threat is made right then and there in response to her statement that she is going to call the police, which she does. So we're not talking any length of time down the road. We're just talking this in this one time and location that this threat is made in response to her lawful acts. If he said, I'm going to do this a week from now, or he comes back later on, I think it's a different case, but those are not the facts that we have before the court at this point.
Earlier, I asked Mr. Maravilli about whether, you know, his assumption or premise that there's no overlap between these statutes, the assault fear type statutes and threats of violence. And he said, I think that Murphy said so. Do you have any response to that?
I don't believe Murphy, Your Honor. Murphy only addresses the issue of terroristic threats. And that case was talking about whether acts could constitute a threat under the terroristic threat statute, now threats of violence. It's the same with all of the cases that counsel relies upon, these threats of violence cases. I'm not aware of any case that has said that a threat to violence is mutually exclusive of whether either a domestic assault or assault in the fifth degree. And that's why, again, I go back to that somewhat dubious logic in arguing that because something may constitute a terroristic threat means that it can't be an assault. And the other cases that I've cited previously at least give some credence to the argument that, in fact, this becomes a fact question for a jury. That is that what was his intent at the time when he threatened to kill her and was doing so in response to something that she had every right in the world to do, and it was then and there that it took place. That becomes a fact question at the point. We're beyond statutory interpretation as to whether or not a verbal act can qualify, or a verbal statement can qualify as an act under the statute. We're now talking about the particular facts of the case. And under that standard, again, you have to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict. You have got to give the prosecution the benefit of all the evidence in the case, including witness testimony. And at that point, then assess those facts against the statutory elements. And again, counsel makes a lot of the conditional nature of the threat here. And I don't believe that argument holds water, at least under the several unpublished opinions from this court, but more importantly, the U.S. Supreme Court's in Holloway decided in 1999. And ultimately, it comes down to what are the circumstances proved? And I outlined all of those. And coming down to the final one, and that is that the threat caused her to be scared and fear for her life because she thought she was going to die, which is circumstantial evidence of the defendant's intent. Now, while the defendant wants to spin that and say he could have intended something else, that's not reasonable on these facts. You don't enter into somebody's home in violation of a Danko and threaten to kill them when they're doing something that the law tells them they are entitled to do. That is, call 911, which denotes that this was an emergency in and of itself, and then say, wow, you need to spin that in a way that really doesn't mean that what I said. It's really being taken out of context. I think counsel actually made the argument it was an empty threat. Well, the victim has no way of knowing that's an empty threat. Just like if you're standing there and somebody points a gun at you and says they're going to shoot you, you have no way of knowing whether that gun's loaded or not. You simply know that you're staring down the barrel of a firearm and are going to be scared to death that someone may actually pull the trigger. Turns out that gun may be unloaded. You're no less placed in fear. And again, being placed in fear is in fact circumstantial evidence of the defendant's intent. There's a long line of cases in this state made clear. So it really boils down to is the most reasonable conclusion to be drawn from the evidence. And again, the evidence is to be viewed as a whole in a light most favorable to the verdict. And the prosecution's burden was not to exclude every sole doubt with regard to this. It's only to remove reasonable doubt. And given the facts of this case, specifically including the victim's testimony that she was scared and thought she was going to die because the defendant had threatened to kill her in her own home, that would be sufficient to meet the statutory elements that what he did was an act done with intent to cause fear of another of immediate bodily harm, or more specifically, death in this case. That's why I believe established the defendant's guilt in this case. Even though, as I said from the beginning, I think the prosecutor made his job more difficult than he needed to, because the defendant could have been convicted of burglary in the first degree, threats of violence, which is a felony, which would have been permissive consecutive sentences. There's a whole host of other ways of getting there. But the simple fact is that the evidence in this case meets the statutory elements. The defense counsel's arguments with regard to the terroristic threats case just simply don't hold water, because none of them say that you cannot be convicted of assault on the same conduct. And I go back to the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1971 in State versus Ott, when it pointed out that the prosecutor had alternatives under one provision or another of the assault statute. The fact that it chose one is not deemed to be error, because prosecutors have discretion in which charge they're going to file against someone. And I would note in this case, there was never any argument made before the district court that the prosecutor had abused his discretion in filing the charges that he did. There was actually no argument ever made before the district court, even at trial. There wasn't any request for alternative jury instructions with regard to the offense that the offenses the jury was instructed on. So those arguments are kind of moot, that the prosecutor should have done something differently, because that was never advocated at any point in time before the district court. I see I'm almost out of time here, so I just want to make sure that I left it open if you had any specific questions you wanted to ask me.
I have a question about standard of review, and this is a question I might also ask Mr. Maravilli. I guess I am not at the moment of the mind that this is a case about statutory interpretation to which we explicitly apply a de novo standard of review. Sometimes we have criminal cases where everything depends upon the meaning of the statute. And if there could be two potential meanings, and you know, the choice of one meaning over the other is determinative. Other times the law is perfectly clear and it's simply a matter of the facts, the evidence, and sometimes it's something in the middle, and I guess where potentially there are some this seems to me that really what we're doing is looking at the statute under which that was charged out, and we're asking whether the evidence is sufficient to satisfy that standard. There may be outer limits, but I guess, do you have any comments on my characterization of the nature of the
issue? I see I'm out of time. Can I answer that question, Your Honor?
I'll let you answer.
I'll keep it short. I tend to agree with you, Judge Johnson, because this is really a sufficiency of the evidence argument. That's the way I've addressed it predominantly in my brief. I would say, though, that the idea that whether or not a verbal statement can be treated as an act under the statute would be an issue of statutory interpretation, which would be subject to de novo review. Beyond that, this comes down to traditional sufficiency of the evidence. That is, were the actions of the defendant, the statements that he made, sufficient to meet the immediacy requirement and the intent requirement? And I believe under that, is those issues are decided under traditional standard of review, not de novo. That's the way I at least attempted to argue it in my brief, and that's what I stand by, at least as far as how I believe the case should be decided. And with that, thank you very much.
Thank you. Now we will go back to Mr. Maravilli. Mr. Maravilli, if you'd like to give rebuttal, you may proceed now.
Thank you, Paul Maravilli, again appearing on behalf of appellant Carlos Rosas. Immediate has one meaning. It has been interpreted that way in this state's case law. Respondent indicated he has really no good answer besides that. And I think I would really like to point out that the Craig case he cited, C-R-E-G-G, is also in my brief. That was determined to be assaultive behavior because the defendant said he was going to have someone kill his girlfriend right now. Those were the words. That is what's happening here. This is not an issue of sufficiency of evidence, and that issue is not presented in this appeal. This is how the conduct is to be interpreted according to the statutes the legislature has crafted. Now, I'm sure, and I think it's indicated in the cases, that the victims in Murphy, the victim in Schwepp, after the defendant approached him in the rec hall, the victim in Johnson, and the State v. Brown case I cite from 2014 were all scared in the moment. But because there was not evidence indicating the intent to cause immediate harm, those were not assaults. This is how this case is illustrated in the record. And it is subject to the statutory interpretation de novo review. It is not so much what my client did. I mean, it's in the record, and there's no meaningful way to dispute the record here. It's what it means. And only this court can decide that under the applicable law. Without my client doing anything, words or act, to indicate his intention was to act immediately. It's not an assault. And I respectfully disagree with respondent counsel saying that this is some kind of spin. Well, that really throws the legislature under the bus. I'm not working on spin here. I'm working on carefully crafted, discrete legislative prohibitions as to which conduct is which. And yes, it would be worse if it's charged as a threats of violence versus domestic assault. But I didn't charge this case, nor did Mr. Rosas. The state did. And if they want to convict someone of a crime, they need to charge them under the proper statute that applies to the conduct alleged. So this case does not carry any of the accompanying facts and circumstances in the other cases that I've relied on to indicate the intent to cause immediate harm. For that reason, this conviction must be reversed. Now, I'm not hearing any questions. I'll just address a few more points. I just would like to note that the defendant.
I have, I'm sorry, Mr. Marbule, before you move on, I have a question. So would you agree with the characterization that your argument is that it was not a criminal threat because it was conditional or because it was about the future or both? I'm just wondering how, if you were to package your argument or to summarize it that way, would you choose in either of those words?
I can't take the position, Your Honor, that the conduct as alleged at trial is not criminal. A threat to kill is a criminal act.
Well, not a violation of the offense charge, then, is that
correct? It is something that would be governed fully and, as counsel has pointed out, more severely by the proper statute. Now, the defendants in Smith and Johnson rebut one of counsel's arguments as well. They both argued that they should be charged under different statutes. There's no meaningful distinction here between the fact that they were charged with threats of violence and argued assault versus the flip situation, because statutory interpretation is about following legislative intent. And for this verdict to stand on a threat, again, wholly described by the prosecutor using the same words over and over, if I'm going to jail, it's because I'm going to kill you. For that to fall under the assault statute would go against Johnson, Smith, Craig.
Okay, let me stop you there. My purpose of my question was to understand your argument, and you just focused on the point, the statement, if ABC, I'm going to kill you. Is it your view that that is not a violation of the assault fear statute because, one, it's a conditional statement dependent on some other event, or two, that it's a statement about the future, not the immediate time period, or three, both?
Number two, I don't feel the need to subscribe to the notion of conditional threats here. It is what I would describe as a threat did not interact on immediately. The entire record supports that conclusion, and there is nothing in the record to demonstrate he had the intent to act
and leave. Appreciate the answer. Thank you. Purpose of my question did not get answered.
Thank you. And we will issue includes our calendar for this morning. We was thinking. Thank you very much.